This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Three of the top names in bluegrass, Earl Scruggs, Doc Watson, and Ricky Skaggs, performed together on the new CD, The Three Pickers. The CD is a recording of a concert together, which will be broadcast as a PBS special on July 28th. We'll feature an interview with Earl Scruggs sometime within the next few days. Today we hear from mandolin player and singer Ricky Skaggs. He started off in bluegrass as a child. He sat in with Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs. In 1970, at the age of 15, he joined Ralph Stanley's Clinch Mountain Boys. He later joined the Country Gentlemen and J.D. Crow in the New South, then formed his own band, Boone Creek. Skaggs left the band to back up singer Emmylou Harris. In the early 1980s, he changed direction and became one of the most successful of the new traditional country artists. He had 10 number one country hits between 1982 and 86. He won the Country Music Association's Entertainer of the Year Award in 1985. In the mid-90s, Ricky Skaggs returned to bluegrass and has been one of the leaders of its revival. Let's start with a track from the new CD, The Three Pickers, with Ricky Skaggs singing lead.
Oft I sing for my friends, when death's cold hand I see, when I reach my journey's end, who will sing one song for me? I wonder who will sing for me.
That's Ricky Skaggs with Earl Scruggs and Doc Watson from the new CD, The Three Pickers. Ricky Skaggs, welcome to Fresh Air.
Great to be with you.
You've known Earl Scruggs for a really long time.
A really long time.
Now, you played with him when you were seven back in 1961. How did you get to play with him?
My father never met a stranger, and we had met the backstage guard. His name was Mr. Bell, at the Grand Ole Opry, which was down at the Ryman Auditorium in those days. And Mr. Bell said, okay, I'll let you all backstage, but, you know, you've got to be nice and, you know, don't be bothering people, don't bug them and that kind of thing, you know. And because my dad was always trying to get me noticed, you know, by influential people. And so Earl Scruggs just happened to walk by, and I was standing there playing the mandolin. And he heard me play and got to talking to my dad and said, well, bring this little boy down next week for an audition on our television show, the Martha White television show. And we did, and I got the audition, won that, and they set a date for me to come in the studio and record it, you know, when they were, the next time they were going to be recording. And it was as simple as that. It's pretty amazing to think that it was that simple, but it really, really was. It was just one of those magic moments in time that really did happen.
So what did Earl Scruggs mean to you and his partner Lester Flatt when you were seven?
Well, you know, they were so popular. They were such a big group. I mean, they were so famous, and that was even before the Beverly Hillbillies. And, you know, they were Grand Ole Opry stars. And, you know, I got to play with Bill Monroe when I was 6 years old up in Kentucky. He came to our hometown, and I got to be on stage with him, so I had a little taste of, you know, being around a star. But they were just so inspirational. They had such great music. They had a great band. The songs they sang were really, really good. I really loved the gospel songs that they sang. They really had a great quartet, and just Earl's banjo playing was so good, and it just inspired me to be good on the mandolin. I mean, I wanted to be. You know, I wanted to be good like Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs and you know, Benny Martin, which was a wonderful fiddle player that used to play with Flatt and Scruggs years ago, and Paul Warren and Josh Graves, and those great players that they had in the band at different times. And so they were very inspirational. I guess personally, you know, they didn't take me on the road with them or anything like that, you know, but they were always nice to me and treated me with respect, you know, and encouraged me, you know. You know, this boy can go places, Mr. Skaggs, you know, you ought to keep it, you know, that kind of thing with my dad, you know. So they were wonderful people, and I just, you know, it was great to get to know them through the years. And Lester Flatt passed away, you know, about 10 years ago. And so it's unfortunate that he's not around to enjoy all this great thing that's going on with bluegrass and roots music these days.
So you actually performed with Bill Monroe before performing with Flatt and Scruggs. How did you get to play with Bill Monroe's band?
Well, he came to Martha, Kentucky, which is a little small town close to Blaine, Kentucky, where I was raised. And they played the high school, and we, my mom and dad and I, my brothers and sister went to see him. And we watched him unload, and, oh, man, that was the coolest thing to see him get out of this big stretch limousine that they were riding in. And looked like they just walked out of the dry cleaners. There wasn't a wrinkle anywhere, you know. And they looked so stinking cool. And they got the bass fiddle off, you know, off the rooftop, and they set up a little sound system, and we went in and sat down and listened to them play. And about 20 or 30 minutes into the show, some of the neighbors in the hood started, you know, requesting, let little Ricky Skaggs get up and sing, you know. And I see it in my own life now, you know, where people start, you know, making those kind of requests, you know, when I'm out on the road playing now. But after, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of that, finally Mr. Monroe said, well, where's he at? You know, and he didn't have any idea who little Ricky Skaggs was. And so I come walking up to the front of the stage, and he reaches down and picks me up and sets me on the stage and says, what do you play, boy? And I said, well, I play the mandolin, sir. And so he took his mandolin off of his shoulder and wrapped it around the, you know, made the strap fit me, you know, and I stood there and sang a Bob and Sonny Osborne song called Ruby, Are You Mad at Your Man? For a six-year-old to be singing a song like that, you know. But it was the biggest thing that had ever happened, you know, to me in my life at that time, being 6 years old and getting to play with the father of bluegrass music, Bill Monroe.
So were you good? Were you really good?
You know, Terry, it's really funny. I've got tapes that I'm so thankful that my father made. Old reel-to-reel tapes. I've got a ton of those things at home. He kept those like fine diamonds. I mean, he kept them, you know, in a box and was very, very careful with them, you know, and I've got a bunch of those things at home. And it's amazing now as I go through and listen to them how well I could play when I was 6, 7, 8 years old. I mean, I wasn't what Chris Thiele was when he was, you know, 8 or 9 or 10. But, you know, mandolin playing hadn't advanced like it has now, you know. But it's pretty amazing to hear me and my mom and dad sing harmony together and hear me play the mandolin. I could tell that I really had a gift, you know, a precious gift. And I'm so glad that I, you know, have followed through with it and really used that gift and nurtured it, honed it, made it sharp, and tried to use it as a tool now to make music and to make a living for my family.
It's lucky you were destined to play mandolin and not, say, baritone saxophone or tuba or something, because it would have been much larger than you were.
Yes, it would have been very hard. And, of course, that wasn't a popular instrument, you know, in Lawrence County, Kentucky.
What, no.
The mandolin, the banjo, and the fiddle was right. Very, very popular instruments. You know, old-time music was, bluegrass was a very popular sound there in the mountains and the hills.
Did you always sing? Like you sang from when you were a child.
I did. My mother used to tell me stories. She's since passed on, but she used to tell me stories. She would hold me in her arms, and I could remember this. She would hold me in her arms in church, and I would sing harmony with her, and my dad would play guitar, and I would sing harmony with her, I was very young at the time, and you know, 3, 4 years old. And the worst thing about having to sing in church is I had to always give up my chewing gum. My mother would make me spit my chewing gum out, and that was a real bummer. I hated that. Just about the time it got really good, I had to give it up and spit it out. You know, that's just a bad memory.
Is there a certain harmony that's like wired into your head from when you were really young, a certain like interval that you always sang?
Right. I always heard the third. You know, that's the tenor line is what we call it. If the lead was the one, and the tenor would be the third, and the baritone would be the fifth. Usually, the fifth would come below, you know, the lead, and until the Stanley Brothers moved it up above the third, which was really cool. But that's the part that I always heard. My mother said she would be working, doing her chores at home, cooking or whatever, and I would be in the other room playing with my toys, and she'd be singing in the kitchen, and she could hear me harmonizing with her in the other room at a young age. It was just, here again, it was just a gift that I could hear that part, you know, because I guess because she would sing that part with my dad when my dad was home. He worked out of town a lot because he was a welder, and he had to travel a lot to wherever the best jobs were, and I would hear them sing, and that was the part that made sense to me was the third.
Well, while we're talking about harmony, why don't we play another track from the new CD, Three Pickers? And you're harmonizing on this with Doc Watson. And the song is What Would You Give? Are you singing a third higher than Doc Watson
yes.
on this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love this song.
Yeah, it's a great performance. So here you are with Doc Watson and Earl Scruggs from the new CD, Three Pickers.
Brother afar from the Savior today, risking your soul for the things that decay. Oh, if today God should call you away, what would you give in exchange for your soul? What would you give
in exchange?
What would you give
in exchange?
What would you give in exchange for your soul? Oh, if today God should call you away, what would you give in exchange for your soul?
It's Ricky Skaggs singing with Doc Watson, Earl Scruggs on banjo, from the new CD, Three Pickers. There are so many bluegrass and country gospel songs that are about death or about losing your soul. What did those songs mean to you as a kid? Were they frightening at all?
Yeah, I've had lots of counseling since then. No, I'm just teasing. The Little Girl and the Dreadful Snake used to scare me to death when I heard that song by Bill Monroe and Jimmy Martin back in the 50s, late 50s.
What's, I don't know that one. What's the other?
The Little Girl and the Dreadful Snake. It was about this little girl that wandered out in the woods and got bit by a snake, and, you know, she dies, you know, and it's just, oh, it just made me so afraid of snakes, you know. Of course, I don't have a lot for snakes even to this day, but there was a lot of songs, like you said, about death and about, you know, death is real. I mean, a lot of people think that you know, death is just, you know, just a dream or something, but it really is real. And I guess with the Irish and Scottish influence in the mountains of Kentucky and western North Carolina, east Tennessee, and the Appalachians there, just our ancestors, we really knew how to grieve. And, you know, I know the Irish, you know, immigrants certainly grieved a lot because I think they really missed their homeland, and it was just part of something that, you know, I know my mother really grieved over my father or her father and of course my father too when he passed away in 96, and she grieved, you know, till the day she passed away, and it was just something that she really couldn't quite deal with and get over, you know, and I don't know if it's a cultural thing that, you know, they think if you get over it that you don't care about them, you know, or is it something that you, you know, you just actually feel and, you know, and you're going through and it's part of a healing process. But by and large, most of the music that kids heard was the same music that adults listened to, you know. And so if it had to deal with mother and her passing or the death of a loved one or the afterlife or faith, the salvation, or what happens if you don't have salvation, you know, and those kind of songs. And they were real, and they really did put a, I don't know, they put something in, you know, in the back of your mind. They would challenge you to think, you know, and, mm-hmm. And maybe grow up.
What was your church like?
Well, we were Foot Washing Baptist. It's called, you know, it was Free Will Baptist. And
where does the foot washing come in?
the foot washing, they would take that, you know, Jesus did that to the disciples, you know, before, you know, at the Last Supper. Mm-hmm. And that was a, you know, the Baptists would do that. Certain denominations of Baptists would do that, would kind of follow that that ritual, you know, around Easter time, that kind of thing. And it was is usually after the service, but it was still part of the service. And the men would wash the men's feet, and the women would wash the women's feet. And it's a very, very humbling experience. If you've never had a 75 or 80 year old, you know, man get down and, you know, and wash your feet as a young man, it's very, very humbling, especially someone that you've looked up to all your life. You don't feel worthy, you know, of some precious old saint, you know, that that you've lived around all your life, that you knew was a very godly man, to humble himself and get down on his knees and wash your feet. I mean, it's a very breaking of the heart, you know, and a very humbling thing. And it lasted many, many years, and now it's almost a thing of the past. You hardly ever hear of that anymore.
You had some classic 80s haircuts also. I think that should not go unremarked.
Those.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Mac mullet. I had a few of those those mullet hairdos. My kids look back at them now, and they said, "Dad, I can't believe that you had that." And I said, "Well, hey, it was the style then."
They made me do it.
They made me do it.
So what kind of entourage did you have to travel with when you were on the road?
Well, I didn't have bodyguards or anything like that, you know, because those women weren't, you know, trying to get to me and everything like that. But I guess the biggest group that we carried was about 21 people on the road. We had two buses and a tractor trailer. And, you know, we had a pretty good payroll every week. And I'm so thankful that I can travel in one bus now and carry the band, carry the concessions, carry all of our instruments and everything underneath the bus. And I mean, you do the math. It is it is much more a tight, sound, it's a whole lot better situation for me now, especially now that I'm recording for Skaggs Family Records. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, your own label. Yeah. You know, I'm just thinking, there's so many things that so many performers in country music do, because that's what you're supposed to do in country music, and at some point you wonder why. Like, why does it go on like that? You know, like some of the costumes and even the hats, like the famous hat acts. Why?
Right.
It's such an obvious, you know, kind of like shtick. Why does it continue?
I was a hair act.
What, you were a hair act?
I just had big hair. I didn't have a hat. I never could find a hat that would fit my big old head. But
right.
And it wasn't big in pride either. It was just big because it was big. My mother said, well, anyway. I guess in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s through the early 60s, you know, the nudie suits, the big flashy, all that, you know. I think there was a lot of artists that really felt that, you know, when a hard-working mom and dad came to the Grand Ole Opry and paid their money to come and see you, you know, you need to treat them the best you can treat them. You know, you don't need to be dressed just like they are.
Right.
They expect better. They've paid money. They don't want to see you dressed like they are. Because if they do, then you don't look any different, you know, even though you may sing like, you know, the person they come to see. They want to see you dressed to the nines, you know. And so I really think a lot of that was for show. You know, it was before videos. It was before, mm-hmm. you know, the big wide screens. And, you know, if you were setting 40 or 50 rows back, you know, one of those red flashy suits, you could see it all the way, you know, 80 rows back, you know.
Yeah, good point.
And it was just something about, you know, presentation. I think it was a theatrical kind of look, you know. And but I never went, you know, I never got into the real loud, flashy, shiny clothes and that kind of thing. And I think that's just almost died out now in Nashville. Mm-hmm. You know, Alan Jackson still wears a really cool look, you know, and he kind of carries some of that Hank Williams thing with him, you know, and I think that's cool, you know. And, you know, Brad Paisley every so often will throw on a nudie coat, you know, that he's gotten, and with a pair of jeans, which is kind of now and then, you know, kind of look.
Right.
And I'm cool with that, you know.
Right.
But
right.
not a whole lot of the guys. Now, there is some rockabilly guys here in town, you know, or some of the, like BR 549 was a group that they were very retro. They wanted to look like the 50s, so they wore everything 50s. They drove, you know, an old car. They, you know, their wives would, you know, would dress up in, you know, in can-cans and, you know, and you know, the little poodle, you know, skirts and all that kind of stuff. And it was, you know, it was great to, you know, just to see them hanging out, you know, because they just kind of lived like they were still in the 50s, you know. But here again, that's a lot of people would look at that as almost making fun of that, you know, but it really wasn't. I mean, they right. loved that music and that style and that time.
1996 was a really life-changing year for you. Your father died, Bill Monroe died, and you left country music and returned to bluegrass. Did the death of your father and the death of Bill Monroe connect at all with your returning to bluegrass?
Well, I think it did. Those two men were very, very strong pillars in my life. My dad, you know, had really taught me from, you know, the cradle. You know, he had really worked with me, very patient man. Had worked with me and teaching me a lot about music and about how to play it. And Bill Monroe was such an inspiration. He was like a musical father to me. And I knew both of those men really wanted me to be playing bluegrass again. And country music in 96 was really starting to, I don't know, it was starting to really, really change. And I don't know, I just saw the writing on the wall. I mean, I was not new country anymore. The kind of country music that I was wanting to record was really what I had recorded since 81, you know, and pretty much traditional country music, you know, trying to find really great songs mm-hmm. that said something, songs that had a meaning and love songs, and that just didn't seem to be what was selling on the radio. And so I really felt, you know, too, in my spirit, that there was a real paradigm shift about to change, about to take place. And I felt like that at Mr. Monroe's death, that there was really going to be a change in this music. I just felt like that when he passed away, that there was going to be, you know, just a new audience for the music. And I really think that that happened. I think that really, when I look back at it now, I really think that it did happen. I wanted to go back. There was no way that anyone could take Bill Monroe's place, and I didn't, I certainly didn't come back to take his place, but I wanted to come back and take Ricky Skaggs's place, because I really felt like that I had a place in bluegrass, and even though I got out of bluegrass, I took bluegrass with me into country music, and now I wanted to return with the knowledge and understanding of business and the understanding of recording and putting on a show. I wanted to take all the things that I had learned and come back, you know, and bring it back to this music. And I really started the record label and all that stuff. And so in 96, it was a bittersweet time. I mean, like you mentioned, my father passed away, Mr. Monroe passed away, but there was even with that death, there was a new birth and a new life that came from that. And I think it was a turning point in my career. A lot of people says, man, you're the smartest guy in the world, you know, but it was just one of those things that I felt in my heart that I really needed to do, and it was the right thing.
You have your own record label now called Skaggs Family Records, and one of the recordings of yours on that label is a recording of gospel music.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought we could hear a song from that. This is called The Darkest Hour. Story behind the song?
Well, here again, it's another great Stanley Brothers song that I learned many years ago. It's also a song that Emmy Lou recorded for her album Roses in the Snow. And really, I guess it was the first time that the general public had ever heard Ricky Skaggs sing. I say the big market, Emmy Lou's market, the country music market. She allowed me to sing a verse in that song, in her version of that. And I'm always grateful for Emmy Lou and Brian for allowing me to sing on that. I was a completely unheard of singer, and Emmy Lou gave me an opportunity to do that, and it was just a great blessing, and I'm always grateful for them. But I love this song. It really has a great promise in it for those that believe, and I think it's a wonderful recording. I'm glad we had a chance to do it from the album Soldier of the Cross.
So from that album, Soldier of the Cross, this is Ricky Skaggs and his band Kentucky Thunder.
The sun is slowly sinking. The day is almost gone. Still darkness falls all around us, and we must journey on. The darkest hour is just before dawn. The narrow way leads home. Lay down your soul at Jesus' feet. The darkest hour is just before dawn.
That's Ricky Skaggs and his band Kentucky Thunder from the CD Soldier of the Cross, which is a CD of gospel music. I think I have mostly played your more soulful country and bluegrass songs today and gospel songs. But I should say you also do this great, like, really up-tempo kind of stuff. But I read that Bill Monroe once said to you when you were playing really fast in a concert, "What do you think of a man who plays my music that fast?" Did he object to you playing very fast?
Well, you know, he never really got to hear us play hard-driving, in-your-face bluegrass like we're playing nowadays. You know, I wish he could have, because we were playing that with the country band. But I've also, it's really funny that we'd have this conversation today about this, because I was in my car just earlier today. I was talking about, or thinking about, a time when we played one of his instrumentals called Wheel Hoss on the stage of the Opry, and I had him come out and play mandolin with us, with the full country band, with steel, electric guitar, drums, piano. And when he came off stage, he said, "That's the best right there that song's ever been played." You know, I thought, are you kidding? I mean, this was with the country band. I mean, but he wouldn't have said that had he not meant it, you know. But, you know, it's funny because he would always joke about things like that, and you'd think that he was really, really serious, you know. And you know, he'd come back 10 minutes later and say something, you know, just the contrary. So you had to know him. You had to know his heart. But we love playing this music with fire and passion and excitement. I think that's what gets people's attention. They love it to hear it, you know, and it's really hard to sit and listen to music like that without patting your foot and getting involved in it, you know. And my theory is if you can experience it through a live concert where you can smell it, touch it, taste it, feel it, you know, you're hooked on the music. You know, you'll never be the same.
Well, Ricky Skaggs, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's great being with you today, Terry. Thank you.
Ricky Skaggs plays with Doc Watson and Earl Scruggs on the new concert CD, The Three Pickers. The concert will be shown as a PBS special on July 28th.
Was y'all ready to tear it up? All right, Jimmy. No matter what I say or do, you're never satisfied. I've tried and tried so many times. I'm leaving now, goodbye. I'm riding on that midnight train. My head's a hanging low. These awful blues will follow me wherever I may go. Oh, why on earth was I ever born? I'll never understand. To fall in love with a woman like you, in love with another man. I'm riding on that midnight train, my head